Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Thursday, March 4. I'm your reader, Kathleen. Our first article from the front page, Iowa Governor opts for Johnson & Johnson shot. This story's by Erin Murphy. Demonstrating her faith in the newly approved one-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine against COVID-19, Governor Kim Reynolds was injected with it Wednesday on live television. Reynolds, along with her husband Kevin and State Public Health Director Kelly Garcia, received inoculations partway through a news conference at the Iowa PBS studios. Reynolds said she waited until now to receive a COVID-19 vaccine to defer to other Iowans in populations more vulnerable to the infection's most severe effects. She said she chose to receive the J&J shot to show Iowans it is safe and effective as the others. The previously approved vaccines from Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech require two shots taken 3 to 4 weeks apart. While the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was shown in clinical trials to prevent virus deaths and severe symptoms, it has been tested as being less effective in preventing moderate symptoms. But infectious disease and public health experts say that should not dissuade anyone from getting the J&J vaccine, which they say is just as effective as the others at preventing individuals from being hospitalized by COVID-19. I wanted to ensure Iowans that I believe it is safe and not to be afraid of it, Reynolds said after receiving the shot in her left arm. I also wanted to make sure that our healthcare workers were vaccinated. I wanted to make sure that residents and staff in our assisted living facilities, that they were able to get the vaccine. I wanted to make sure that essential workers, our educators, and other populations were able to get the vaccine. To support her point about the new vaccine, Reynolds invited to speak at the news conference Dr. Patricia Winokur, Executive Dean of the University of Iowa's College of Medicine and Professor of Infectious Disease and Internal Medicine. This is a great vaccine, Winokur said. People have gotten caught up on that 70% efficacy versus 90, but remember this vaccine, when you really look carefully at the data, it is exceptionally good at preventing severe disease and hospitalizations. Winokur said annual flu vaccines also are roughly 70% effective, which she called outstanding. But the fact that these vaccines are close to 100% effective at preventing hospitalizations is the statistic that people should be watching, she said. Reynolds and Garcia said they both felt good roughly 15 minutes after receiving the vaccine. More than 350,000 people in Iowa have received one dose of the vaccine, and more than 196,000 have received both. Roughly 2.5 million Iowans are 18 years and older, according to the U.S. Census figures, and thus eligible to receive the vaccine at some point. Reynolds and state public health officials said Iowa's low rate of residents who have received their second dose has been due in part to slow reopening in the federally led program in which pharmacies conduct vaccinations. State officials said thousands of doses were administered but have not yet been reported to the federal government. Once those figures are reported by the pharmacies, Iowa's numbers and rate of second doses should increase, officials said. Also on the front page of the Gazette today, Iowa City Schools enacting LGBTQ health curriculum. This story is by Grace King. As part of an equity initiative, the Iowa City Community School District is implementing a health and puberty curriculum that's inclusive of LGBTQ and non-binary students. The new curriculum, called 3 R's for Rights, Respect, and Responsibility, is a free K-12 sex education curriculum written by the Washington, D.C.-based Advocates for Youth. The program meets the national sexual education standards and is inclusive of issues related to sexual orientation and gender identity. The Iowa City District's commitment to being inclusive extends to students in the LGBTQ, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer community, said Diane Shoemaker, the district's executive director of teaching and learning. Non-binary refers to those who do not identify exclusively as either male or female. A non-binary person may feel a mix of genders or not identify with any gender at all. Horn Elementary School Counselor Heidi Hassan said she has conversations with students who identify in a lot of different ways, and it's important to have an inclusive curriculum so students learn that all bodies are good bodies. There's a lot of ideas about what is and what is not okay to teach, but the reality is we have non-binary and trans children in our schools, K-12. It's important they see themselves in the curriculum, Hassan said. Hassan is part of a team reviewing the health and puberty curriculum of 4th through 6th graders. As a school counselor, she teaches lessons on body boundaries and how to report abuse and talk to a trusted adult. The district started implementing new guidelines for teaching the puberty education curriculum in the fall of 2019, beginning with no longer separating students into groups of boys and girls for lessons. The district is now working on implementing a curriculum for 4th through 6th graders with United Action for Youth, which serves at-risk young people in Johnson County, by providing mental health counseling and social services to teens and their families. When someone with the authority of a teacher describes the world and you are not in it, it's as if you looked into a mirror and saw nothing, Hassan said, quoting Adrienne Rich, a renowned poet, essayist, and feminist who died in 2012. That stuck out to me because students may not see themselves represented, and that leads them to look for their own answers, Hassan said. Instead of them getting unhealthy information about sexuality and gender identity, it's important they get healthy, research-based information. Stanzi Sheets, health educator with United Action for Youth, has helped teach sexual health education to 8th and 9th graders at the Iowa City schools for the past 3 years, and also is a consultant with the district on the elementary curriculum. A non-binary health curriculum includes things like using neutral language, like they-them pronouns for an individual, and not gendering body types, Sheets said. It can help students feel safe in school and be kind to all people regardless if they have different cultural or religious beliefs. Many health curricula focus on people in heterosexual relationships, Sheets said, leaving out children who are gay, non-binary, or transgender. That can heighten the risk of sexually transmitted infections, unintended pregnancies, and bullying. Schumacher said parents are alerted ahead of time when a puberty or sex ed lesson is planned for their child's class, and they are welcome to review the curriculum if they like. We want parents to be involved and become askable, Schumacher said. Talking about different gender identities or sexual orientation does not encourage students to become that, Schumacher said. This is part of who they are. But I do understand the concern parents may have, she said. We really do hope parents can trust us and be partners with us, but parents can opt out if they have objections to the curriculum. Bills in the Iowa legislature that this year could affect the district's approach if they were to become law. Senate File 167, which cleared a Senate subcommittee February 16, would prohibit schools from including gender identity in a health curriculum for 1st through 6th graders, unless written consent is obtained from the parent or guardian. Senate File 80, which has not passed out of subcommittee, would require schools to share students' preferred pronouns with a parent upon request. Senate File 224, which is unlikely to advance this session, would ban transgender Iowa students from using bathrooms that correspond with their gender identity. Iowa City district policy calls for students having access to the facility that matches their gender identity, Schumacher said. Sheets said it feels like there's a climate of bullying coming from the Iowa legislature. In school, we're supposed to teach kids to be respectful, kind, open-minded, and accept other people, yet our leaders are pushing through legislation that speaks against that, Sheets said. I have dreams of a world where everyone from the top down is living harmoniously. But it begins with education. Moving on to the Iowa Today page, a driver fleeing Lynn deputy dies in a crash. This story is contributed by Kat Russell. A man fleeing authorities at speeds of up to 115 miles per hour was killed Wednesday morning when he was ejected as the minivan he was driving crashed, the Lynn County Sheriff's Office said. A passenger trapped in the vehicle was extricated and flown with serious injuries to the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics. Authorities did not release the names of the male driver or the female passenger. The episode began at 3:49 a.m. when a Linn County deputy saw a silver Dodge Grand Caravan without license plates that appeared to be prowling a residential area in Atkins, the sheriff's office said. After the minivan's driver ran a stop sign, the deputy tried to stop him, but the driver refused, and the chase began. The chase went south from Atkins and then west on Highway 30. The pursuit continued south on Highway 21 into Belle Plaine and east on 77th Street Drive until it ended at 4:09 a.m. when the driver went off the road and struck a culvert on 77th Street Drive near 14th Avenue Drive in Benton County. The driver died at the scene. The passenger's injuries were not thought to be life-threatening. According to Linn County Sheriff's Office policy, deputies may initiate a chase when it is reasonable to believe that a suspect who has been given an appropriate signal to stop by a law enforcement officer is attempting to evade arrest or detention by fleeing in a vehicle. The policy calls for deputies to weigh the seriousness of the crime, the safety of the community, the type of area, time of day, the number of vehicles and pedestrians in the area, road conditions, the availability of backup, and whether there are passengers in the suspect vehicle before starting a pursuit. The policy says a chase should be ended whenever the totality of objective circumstances known or which reasonably ought to be known to the deputy or supervisor during the pursuit indicates that the present risks of continuing the pursuit reasonably appear to outweigh the risks resulting from the suspect's escape. The crash remains under investigation by the Iowa State Patrol. This story also on the Iowa Today page by Lee Hermiston, drug charges grow from an Iowa City homicide case. A fatal shooting took place last month in the apartment of a locally prominent Black Lives Matter movement leader who is now in jail on unrelated charges, records show. Iowa City Police Chief said that Quincy Russom, age 19, was shot and killed February 12 at 615 South Governor Street, number 6. According to Iowa City Police criminal complaints and court records, that apartment is the home of Mazen M. Mohammadali, age 20. Criminal complaints state that Iowa City Police served a search warrant February 24 at Mohammadali's apartment. Police said they found 56.13 grams of marijuana and 42.5 ecstasy pills. Muhammad Ali was arrested Tuesday and faces two counts each of controlled substance violation and Iowa drug tax stamp violation, as well as a count of keeping a drug house. Muhammad Ali also is accused of violating his probation for a second-degree robbery conviction, according to the Department of Correctional Services report. The defendant continues to display the same continued behavior of selling narcotics, the report states. This criminal conduct continues to pose a significant risk to the community. It should be noted a homicide was committed at the defendant's residence on 2/12/21. Iowa City Police Lieutenant Scott Gard said Muhammad Ali's drug-related arrest began with the homicide investigation, but he would not answer any further questions, including whether police believe Muhammad Ali was present for the shooting or whether he knew Russom or 22-year-old Sammy Hamed, who faces a first-degree murder charge in the case. Those answers are still under investigation at this time, as this matter remains open and still very much active, Gard said in an email. Muhammad Ali, who previously identified himself as an Iowa Freedom Riders leader, was arrested in June 2020 for what authorities said were his actions during Black Lives Matter protests. He initially faced 6 charges, including a felony, and was jailed in Marshall County, but he ultimately pleaded guilty to just 1 simple misdemeanor. This movement is all about making personal sacrifices for the greater good, Muhammad Ali said through his attorneys in June. My conviction is a small price to pay for the dividends that our movement has already brought in the city of Iowa City. Muhammad Ali's latest charges carry a potential sentence of 27 years in prison. He remains in Johnson County Jail. In another Iowa Today story, Cedar Rapids Clinic sets up vaccine phone line. This story is by Michaela Ram. The Eastern Iowa Health Center has announced a dedicated phone line for people 65 and older to call and schedule an appointment for a coronavirus vaccine. The federally qualified health center in Cedar Rapids is offering 2 doses of the Moderna vaccine to qualifying older Iowans. Anyone 65 and older can call to schedule an appointment this week or next week on a limited basis. Once the center has scheduled appointments for the vaccines it has, it will start a wait list of patients for the next available vaccine doses. To schedule an appointment, call 319-730-7300. That number again is 319-730-7300. If the line is busy or the call goes unanswered, leave a message. Officials say they will return calls as soon as possible. Those who receive the first dose will be immediately scheduled for the follow-up shot at a later date. The center serves patients in Lynn, Benton, Iowa, Johnson, and Jones counties, but appointments are not limited to residents of those counties. It's easy to call and make an appointment, Ellie Steffen, the clinic's chief operations officer, said in a news release. The Community Health Free Clinic in Cedar Rapids also is compiling a wait list for people 65 and older who want a vaccine. It is taking calls from 9 to 11 Monday through Thursday, and the number at the free clinic is 319-200-2550. Again, that number at the free clinic, 319-200-2550. Also on the Today page, Des Moines superintendent could lose his job. This is an AP story out of Des Moines. A decision by the superintendent of Iowa's largest school district to stick with remote learning in the midst of a pandemic could end up costing him his job. The Iowa Board of Educational Examiners is seeking to strip Des Moines Public Schools Superintendent Thomas Ehart of his administrator license, saying it found probable cause that Ehart failed to submit or implement a lawful plan to return students to the classroom for the 2020-2021 school year. TV station WOI reported on Wednesday. The license is a state requirement to hold the position of school superintendent in Iowa. At the time of Ehart's decision, Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds required schools to provide at least 50% of teaching in classrooms and allowed districts to seek temporary reprieves to teach online only when virus activity rose to especially high levels. In January, Reynolds signed into law requirements that schools offer a full-time in-person option, despite an outcry from teachers, school nurses, and other educational professionals who said pushing children back into classrooms during the pandemic wasn't safe. The examiner's board, which is appointed by the governor, has given Ehart the choice to surrender his license or agree to accept a lesser sanction. The board cites complaints received September 30 and October 21 that Des Moines schools had not returned to in-person teaching. Ehart is scheduled to appear May 20 before an administrative law judge. Des Moines School Board Chairman Dwana Bradley and Vice Chairman Rob Barron defended Ehart in a written statement on Wednesday, saying his decisions on remote learning were made at the direction of the school board. They also pushed back on the Board of Education examiner's findings, saying Des Moines schools have been in compliance with in-person learning requirements and have been making instructional time from the beginning of the year. Moving on now to the Insight page, the Gazette's editorial is titled Pass Targeted COVID-19 Relief. Federal leaders are scrambling this week to assemble a coronavirus relief package that can earn approval from Congress. The U.S. House last week approved a nearly $2 trillion package that aims to address urgent pandemic needs, along with some of Democrats' long-term priorities. That version of the bill is not set to be taken up by the U.S. Senate. We urge Congress to do what's doable and pass a narrowly targeted COVID-19 response, focusing on direct stimulus payments to individuals, an extension of pandemic-related unemployment benefits, and resources for state and local governments to administer vaccines. In some sense, every issue is related to the coronavirus pandemic. The year-long ordeal has cut across almost every aspect of our lives and exposed long-standing failures of our political, economic, and social systems. Nevertheless, tangentially related measures, such as a national minimum wage increase to $15, are best considered individually, rather than as part of urgently needed COVID-19 relief legislation. It would be nice to see our federal legislators actually legislate, propose ideas, debate them on their merits, and then give up or down votes. Instead, massive bills are the product of high-level, behind-the-scenes negotiations among top officials and a few key swing voters in Congress. Approving $2,000 checks to Americans was a key issue in pivotal special elections for U.S. Senate in Georgia in January. That was almost 2 months ago, and people are still waiting. 2 months of rent, child care payments, groceries, and other expenses at a time when families are struggling to make ends meet. Meanwhile, expanded unemployment assistance, which was approved by Congress in last December's relief package, is set to expire this month. Passing a bill within the next 2 weeks to extend those benefits is imperative. And some states still are struggling to put together widespread and equitable vaccine plans. Bolstering that effort through more federal funding will pay dividends long into the future. It is a testament to the gross dysfunctionality of Congress that members can't even come together to do basic things that constituents explicitly sent them there to do. Again, that's the Gazette's own editorial. And the 24-hour Dorman column is titled, Bill Permits Iowans to Discriminate. Supporters of making Iowa the latest state to enact a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA, insist it's really nothing to be alarmed about, or maybe it's a very big deal. The bill, Senate File 436, would require courts in Iowa to apply the highest level of judicial review, also known as strict scrutiny, when weighing cases involving Iowans who break the law because of their sincerely held religious beliefs. The state would have to prove its law serves a compelling governmental interest and is narrowly tailored to meet that objective. Proponents at a subcommittee meeting hearing this week argued the federal RFRA has been on the books since 1993, so no biggie. But Chuck Hurley of the Family Leader argued the bill would restore the beauty and power of the First Amendment. So, biggie, maybe. Few people who pursue a defense under RFRA win in court, supporters contended. But Brad Cranston, founder of Iowa Baptists for Biblical Values, said the bill would be the first step to protect Iowans from the soft totalitarianism of the left. Backer said it would simply give Iowans their day in court. But Senator Dennis Guth, Republican from Clemmy, said this is about people who believe man can change the laws of nature with policies forced on people. Guth also spoke of the need to protect the inner soul of man. But what do Republicans and other backers truly want? What do they want to do that they can't do now? No one said specifically. It's not tough to surmise. The spread of state-by-state RFRA bills has coincided with LGBTQ Americans fighting for and winning civil rights protections. RFRA supporters want permission to opt out of progress and discriminate against LGBTQ Iowans. They want to deny them services, public accommodations, housing, employment, etc., by asserting their religious beliefs. Iowa's Civil Rights Act prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientation, and has since 2007. These folks want a bypass around the law. Yes, there is a federal RFRA, but it's Iowa state courts that settle questions of constitutional equity in our state. Iowans asserting their religious beliefs can already have their day in court, and it's the courts, not the legislature, that should decide what level of judicial review these cases receive. Once again, Republicans who fear they can't win in court want to put a thumb on the scale. Too bad we can't apply a strict scrutiny standard to some of the garbage bills moving this session. But if RFRA dies, as it has in previous sessions, we can again thank the state's business community. Joe Murphy of the Iowa Business Council testified that given the state's paltry projected population growth, the last thing lawmakers should do is make the state less welcoming and inclusive. Our economic future depends on it, Murphy said. Similar messages were delivered by Wellmark, Principal Financial, and the Technology Association of Iowa. They're among a long list of firms and economic development groups opposed to the bill. Hurley accused business interests of bullying and intimidation, but it's he and his allies who are working to make it okay to bully and intimidate LGBTQ Iowans. Stopping this bill would be a big deal. And again, that's 24-hour Todd Dorman. A community letter today is titled, Welcome to Iowa, Where Sense No Longer Prevails. As Iowa considers updating its welcome signs, perhaps this is an opportunity to highlight our current political environment. We have House Speaker Pat Grassley, whose unwillingness to require face masks in the Capitol puts legislative staff and citizens at an unnecessary risk of COVID-19 exposure, but he bravely defends legislative decorum by sanctioning a legislator who wore blue jeans in protest. We have Representative Steve Holt considering a bill restricting diversity training in schools, drawing support from a Family Leader Foundation representative who declared that Iowa does not have racism. We have Senator Jim Carlin supporting a voter suppression bill due to his belief in the big lie, because his Republican caucus can't accept that their presidential candidate lost. To make his caucus feel better, the bill seeks to reduce voting hours and opportunities for working Iowans. We have Representative Schuyler Wheeler's bill to financially sanction Iowa schools if they use the 1619 Project, an educational curriculum which looks at the impact that slavery has had in Black America, as he claims it seeks to tear down America. Perhaps we could portray each legislator on Iowa's welcome signs as a shining example of how partisan politics seems to be more important than actually working on the behalf of Iowans. And that letter today is signed by John Burke of Cedar Rapids. Back to the Iowa Today page, this story by Aaron Jordan. A company tries again to open a feedlot. Environmental groups spoke out this week against a third attempt to open an 11,600-head cattle feedlot near Monona. The public meeting Monday was over the nutrient management plan submitted by Supreme Beef, owned by Mike Walls, Dean Walls, and Jared Walls. The men had been trying to open a feedlot on the site since 2017, but the proposal has met ongoing opposition from some neighbors and environmentalists concerned about the 34.5 million gallons a year of manure coming from the feedlot polluting streams and groundwater. We have significant concerns about the nutrient management plan, said Mike Schmidt, staff attorney for the Iowa Environmental Council. It proposes over-application of manure, makes unfounded assumptions regarding manure nutrient content, does not list conservation practices, and will pose a threat to water quality in the region. Steve Vasey, a retired Iowa State University employee and water quality advocate, said the computations used in the plan to show how much manure can safely be applied are inadequate. He compared it to having 100 jelly beans separated two different ways. In one method, there are 50 beans in two jars. In another, there are 10 beans in 10 jars. If someone wants to know how many beans you have, you can't multiply the number of jars from the first scenario with the number of beans from the second scenario, VC said. The result is she's claiming 4 times less nitrogen and 6 times less phosphorus than actually will be produced by the manure from the feedlot. The Supreme Beef Nutrient Management Plan was prepared by Becky Sexton of Twin Lake Environmental Services in Rockwell City. Jared Walls attended the virtual hearing but did not speak about the proposal. He said in a meeting August 31st that people often get stuck on the potential pitfalls of a new business venture rather than the good that can come from it. He said at that time the 11,000 cows will be fed with commodities from eastern Iowa. The DNR in October approved Supreme Beef for 2,700 cattle, but the company wants a larger operation. Iowans with additional written comments about the nutrient management plan may email Kelly Book through Monday at kelly.book@dnr.iowa.gov. DNR staff will make a decision about the plan by April 2nd. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, March 4, on IRIS. And now we turn to the obituaries page. In the short notices, From Cedar Rapids, Ruth Ann Dill, age 75, died Wednesday, March 3. Powell Funeral Home and Cremation in Keota is in charge. From Holy Cross, Earl R. Brimeyer, age 82, died Monday, March 1st, Kramer Funeral Home, Holy Cross. In Maquoketa, David P. Muller, age 45, died Tuesday, March 2nd, Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. Also in Maquoketa, Gary M. Warren, age 47, died Tuesday, March 2nd, Carson Celebration of Life, Maquoketa. Moving now to the longer notices from Cedar Rapids, Cassandra W. Burns. Cassandra, known as Sam, age 49, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on March 2nd. There will be a memorial service at 11 a.m. Saturday, March 6th, with a visitation at 10 a.m. All services will be held at Cedar Rapids First Assembly, 3233 Blairs Ferry Road in Cedar Rapids. Please enter through door 3. Also in Cedar Rapids, Nathan Zoe Sisko, age 31, of Des Moines, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away Sunday, February 28th. A celebration of life will be held on Sunday, March 7th at the Bros Chapel from 2 to 5, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Also in Cedar Rapids, Josephine Shadid Daoud passed away at the age of 93, Tuesday, March 2nd, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Cedar Rapids. Funeral services will be held at noon, March 6th, at St. George Orthodox Church in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 Friday, March 5, at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood, 520 Wilson Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids. A procession to St. George Cemetery will immediately follow the church service on March 6th. In Cedar Rapids, Maxine Louise Kimes Smith, age 93, died at home on Tuesday, March 2nd. Private family services will be held. Burial will be at Cedar Memorial Cemetery. Family and friends are welcome to attend a vigil service for Maxine at 4 p.m. Monday at the Tien Funeral Home. Those not attending the vigil service may visit with the family from 4:30 to 7. Also in Cedar Rapids, Frida Marie Williams, age 71, passed away Monday, March 1, at St. Luke's Hospital. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 Friday, March 5, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories stateroom. There will be a private family service with burial at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. From Toddville, Stephen, known as Steve C. Carolan, age 81, passed away Tuesday, March 2nd at his home in Toddville. Family will greet friends from 2 to 5 Sunday, March 7 at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, March 8 at Cedar Hills Community Church in Cedar Rapids. The service will be live streamed at facebook.com/ Cedar Hills Community Church. Private family burial will take place at Dunkard Cemetery in Midway. From North Liberty, Kenneth Albrecht, lifetime resident and businessman, died suddenly at his home. Private family services will be held with burial at the Oakland Cemetery in Iowa City. In lieu of flowers, his family asks that you support the Burr Oak Land Trust with your gifts in memory of Ken, as he was a staunch supporter. To share a thought, memory, or condolence with his family, please visit the funeral home website at www.gayandchia.com. From Iowa City, Paul Yedlichka, age 86, of rural Iowa City, died Monday, March 1st at his home, surrounded by family. Funeral service will be held at noon Friday, March 5, at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church in Iowa City, followed with burial at St. Stanislaus Cemetery in Hills. Visitation for family and friends will be from 4 to 6 Thursday at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made in his memory to Iowa City Hospice or Camp Courageous. To share a thought or memory, go to www.gayandchia.com. And our final obituary today is from Toddville, Dolores M. McCormick, age 94, passed away Tuesday, March 2nd at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. A funeral mass for the family will be held at St. Pius X Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids, conducted by Reverend Philip Thompson. A committal service will be held at Calvary Cemetery in Van Horn. Moving now to the sports page, more state basketball stories, and this first one by Jeff Linder. Hanging around is the story from girls' state basketball. Make history or become history. Thanks to a big first-half surge, the West Branch Bears selected the former. Third-ranked West Branch delivered an early dagger, a 15-0 job that turned the game on its ear and handed number 8 Grundy Center, 49-33, in a Class 2A quarterfinal at the Girls State Basketball Tournament Wednesday at the Wells Fargo Arena. It was the Bears' first victory in 4 state trips. Awesome. I'm just very proud right now, senior guard Sasha Koenig said. Last year when we came here, we were thrilled. Now we're a team that feels we belong here. The Bears, with a record of 21-1, certainly fit right in there with 3 remaining survivors. They will face number 2 Dyke New Hartford, 24-0, in a 2A semifinal at noon on Friday. DNH defeated number 10 Trainer, 44-36, on Wednesday. West Branch has a winning tradition in multiple sports, and we want to put girls basketball in there too, Bears coach Jared Tylee said. A Bradley University signee, Koenig posted 16 points, 7 rebounds, and 6 assists. Delaney Lunekas added 13 points and 12 rebounds and was at her best during the Bears' decisive surge. Lunekas scored 8 points in the second quarter. With preparation comes confidence, and we did it, she said. We play for ourselves, our families, and our school. 4 seniors are in the starting lineup, so this was in the Bears' best shot for an extended stay. Making history, that was our goal, said Taya Young, who added 7 points, as did Ryland Drucker. The Bears were a little slow out of the gate, but jolted the Spartans with that 15-point run in a stretch of 8-plus minutes that began midway through the first quarter and led 25-11 at halftime. Defense was a constant. The Bears collected 11 steals and held the Spartans, 19-4, to a 29% shooting, 13 of 45. We really hang our hats on defense, Koenig said. Grundy Center has 2 solid posts, but we were everywhere. Tylee said we really wanted to limit their posts and keep the ball out of Peyton Wallace's hands, and we did those things. West Branch took its largest lead, 47-25, on Koenig's step-through penetration with about 4 minutes left. Bailey Redding paced Grundy Center with 16 points, stepping out and hitting 4 three-pointers. Another story by Jeff Linder, the Bravettes move on, Bolton powers a late surge. When things started going downhill for Montezuma, that was a good thing. The 6th-ranked Bravettes separated themselves in the fourth quarter from an inaccurate perimeter game, reclaimed momentum, and topped number 3 St. Ansgar 50-45 in a Class 1A quarterfinal at the Girls' State Tournament. We've been shooting a lot out-of-rhythm threes, said Montezuma's Elise Bolton, who led all scorers with 29 points, the most of anybody in any class in the quarterfinal round. We started getting downhill with the drive, and that got us going. Despite shooting 27% from the field, including an ugly 1 of 16 in the third quarter, Montezuma advanced to face number 2 Newell Fonda on 88-47 win over number 7 Kingsley Pearson in a semifinal, 4 o'clock on Friday. The Bravettes turned the tables on St. Ansgar, which eliminated them 51-46 in last year's first round, but revenge wasn't high on their list. We didn't focus on who we were playing, Bolton said. We didn't want to stop playing tonight. We don't want to stop playing until Saturday. That's such a true statement with this group, and it's a unique group, Montezuma coach Janelle Burgess said. They'll come back tomorrow even more focused. They want the next 32 minutes together. The Bravettes led 27-20 at halftime, then things got wonky in the third quarter, enabling the Saints to take a 34-32 edge into the last 8 minutes. This story by Jeff Linder, Springville pushes past number 1 Algona Garrigan at the wire. The scheme was there. The effort most definitely was there. The Springville Orioles simply didn't make quite enough shots to pull a Memorial upset, and it would have been a biggie. Audie Crooks hit 12 of 13 shots in a 25-point, 10-rebound performance, and Molly Joyce converted 6 of 8 free throws in the final 80 seconds as top-ranked Algona Garrigan escaped with a 48-42 victory in a Class 1A quarterfinal at the Girls State Basketball Tournament. A lot of people overlooked us, Springville coach Christina Zaruba said. They didn't think we had a chance. If somebody beats Garrigan, they can send us a thank you note because I think we provided the blueprint. Garrigan at 24-1 will face number 4 Exira EHK 24-0, a 60-55 victory over number 5 Marcus MMCRU in a semifinal 2 o'clock on Friday. The 8th-ranked Orioles made Crooks a strong-bodied 6'3" sophomore who had received offers from all 4 of Iowa's D1 programs work for her numbers. We had Lauren in front of her, and we squished her from behind, Zaruba said. Last year's 1A runner-up, Garrigan, shot to a 14-5 lead early in the second quarter, but Springville was the Golden Bears' equal, at least the rest of the way. In the postseason, we stepped up our defense immensely, Wilson said. We don't like to just sit in a zone. The fearless Orioles were within 23-19 at halftime, then took brief leads at 29-27 and 31-29 in the third quarter. But 26% shooting proved to be too much to overcome. Garrigan held a 39-33 lead early in the fourth quarter, but Grace Mattis's free throws cut it to 41-39 with minutes to go. Joyce then salted it away from the line. It was too close for comfort, said Crooks, who picked up her 4th foul with 3:56 remaining, but never was ticketed with a 5th. I had to stay set on defense, and I had to be aware of any flops they might try and stay in the game. Wilson led Springville with 13 points and 9 rebounds. Mattis added 9 points, and Molly Stamp, Morgan Natchezel, and Hannah March scored 6 apiece. We really played good defense, Mattis said. If we could have made a few more shots. Springville does not have a senior on its roster. We hope to be back here next year, Mattis said. The Girls State Basketball Tournament continues today in Des Moines, and if you'd like to listen on the radio, Iowa City West versus Johnston at 11:45 today on KGYM 106.3. In other games today, Class 5A semifinals, again Iowa City West 14-3 versus number 2 Johnston 17-1. That is a noon tip-off time. Number 1 Waukee at 11-1 versus number 5 Ankeny Centennial. That game is at 10 a.m. And in Class 3A, number 1 Cherokee plays number 4 West Lyon at 2 p.m. Number 2 Clear Lake plays number 3 Unity Christian at 4 p.m. Those are Class 3A semifinals. In Class 4A, number 1 Glenwood plays number 6 North Scott, and number 2 Ballard plays number 3 Dallas Center Grimes. That game is at 8. Moving back to pick up some stories from the Iowa Today page, this story is an AP story, Pipe Bomb Discovery Disrupts Polling Place. The discovery of a live pipe bomb at a central Iowa polling place as voters were casting ballots in a special election forced an evacuation of the building, police said. Officers called to the Lakeside Center in Ankeny around 9:30 a.m. Tuesday found a device that looked like a pipe bomb in grass near the center. Police later confirmed that the device was a pipe bomb. The banquet hall was being used as a polling place for an Ankeny School District special election. Police evacuated the building and the state fire marshal and agents from the FBI and Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives were called in. Technicians safely detonated the device and the center reopened at 12:30. About 3 hours after the device was discovered, no one was injured. Polk County Auditor Jamie Fitzgerald described the device as a metal piece with 2 end caps and said in a Twitter post that a couple walking their dog Tuesday morning had discovered it. I want to also add that there is no way of knowing how long this has been at the Lakeside Center, Fitzgerald said in a tweet, saying officials don't know whether the pipe bomb is related to the election. Fitzgerald and police said other polling places in Ankeny were checked and no other suspicious devices were found. Also on the Iowa Today page, apply now to serve on Cedar Rapids committees. This story by Marissa Payne. Residents may apply for current and upcoming openings on city boards, commissions, and advisory committees. The city said in a news release it is committed to gender balance on all panels. Women, minorities, and qualified individuals with disabilities are encouraged to apply. Most of the 2021 terms expire June 30th, and new terms begin July 1. Terms vary in length depending on the panel. Information on openings and applications can be found online at cedarrapids.org/localgovernment/cityboards and commissions. Residents also may contact the City Clerk's Office at 319-286-5060 or email city-clerk@cedarrapids.org. The mayor and other 8 council members will review applications which are due April 30th. All applications are kept on file for 1 year. Among the openings, to name a couple, are Civil Rights Commission, 2 seats for a 3-year term. Historic Preservation Commission, 3 seats for 3-year terms. Airport Commission, 1 seat for a 3-year term. City Planning Commission, 2 seats for 3-year terms. Applications for the new Citizen Review Board, which the Council unanimously created in February, follow a different timeline. People have until May 31st to apply to be one of the 9 members of the panel charged with oversight of city law enforcement. The Mayor and Council will appoint people to the Review Board in June. Some spots are designated for people involved with racial justice advocacy groups, such as the Advocates for Social Justice, NAACP, and League of United Latin American Citizens. Members of the public may also apply. Information on and applications for the Police Review Board can be found online at cedarrapids.org/CRB. And this story from the Gazette Des Moines Bureau, lawmakers say no state income tax on federal jobless benefits. Iowans will not have to pay state income tax on the temporary federal unemployment compensation they received during the pandemic under a bill passed unanimously by the Iowa House on Wednesday. Representatives agreed to add the provision to a Senate-passed measure that exempted federal Paycheck Protection Program grants and loans given to Iowa businesses. Democrats sought to also exempt state jobless benefits from Iowa income tax, but that effort failed because of its additional cost. Overall, Senate File 364, passed 94-0, will provide up to $115 million in state tax relief to Iowans put out of work because of COVID-19. Another $13 million would carry over into fiscal 2022, according to House GOP staff, with about $103 million coming from the state's Taxpayer Relief Fund and another $25 million from the state's General Fund surplus. This COVID relief package of $115 million is the right thing to do, Lois told his House colleagues. It's the right mechanism to do it. He said the amended relief package, which now returns to the Iowa Senate for consideration, is an attempt to assist Iowa businesses and individuals thrown into turmoil by the pandemic in an equitable and meaningful financial way that was fiscally responsible. We realize there's probably never a way that we're going to make them completely whole, either businesses or individuals, he said. The House action exempts from individual income taxation the extra unemployment compensation idled workers received from 4 federal jobless benefit programs. But the jobless payments such workers received from the state in 2020 still are subject to Iowa income tax on state returns, which must be filed by April 30th. The Paycheck Protection Program exemptions are retroactive to last March and run through tax year 2023. The federal jobless benefits tax break is retroactive to January 1, 2020. I'm smiling under my mask because finally a major bill coming through our chamber with bipartisan support, said Representative Dave Jacoby, Democrat from Coralville. This is a fantastic bill, he added. In fact, from my point of view, this should have been the first bill we did in January. It's much more important than some of the other things we've tackled in the first 6 or 7 weeks. Jacoby said the amended bill will provide tax relief to more than 200,000 Iowans. Democrats sought to exempt state unemployment compensation from state tax too, but Lowe said that cost would have been considerably larger. Jacoby noted that many Iowans are preparing or already have filed their 2020 state tax forms. He urged state officials to work quickly in providing the proper notification and forms to those who need to amend their return, presuming the amended bill wins state Senate approval and is signed into law by Governor Reynolds. "Here it is, March 3," Jacoby said. "A lot of Iowans already have done their taxes. I don't want Iowa to become the state champion for amended returns." In other action Wednesday, representatives by voice vote approved joint rules for the House and Senate that included a new provision prohibiting demonstrations on the second floor of the Iowa Capitol. Representative Brent Segrist, Republican from Council Bluffs, said the new policy would bar shouting, singing, placards, and other demonstrations that would disrupt proceedings in the House or Senate chambers. On the Living page, the story today is titled Master of the Grill. If you go, it's Barbecue Master D. Ham. Search for BBQ Master D. Ham on Facebook and follow his page to learn when and where he's serving jerk meats and sides. This story by Dorothy D'Souza Guedes. Everyone loves the person behind the barbecue grill. That lesson has stuck with Dan Hamilton since his childhood on the south side of Chicago. Every 2 or 3 days, his mom would fire up the grill in some capacity, Hamilton said. When he was 11 or 12, an aunt married and his new uncle took over. "I learned pretty quickly the person behind the grill is held in high regard," Hamilton said. He's found that to be true as BBQ Master D. Ham, the name he's known by in Cedar Rapids. He's a caterer, sometimes restaurant cook, and occasional pop-up purveyor of jerk-seasoned meats. "Jerk seasoning is Jamaican. Is Hamilton?" "No, ma'am. Where I grew up in Chicago, you could throw a stone and find a jerk restaurant. They would jerk water if they could," Hamilton said. Jerk spice traditionally includes hot peppers, allspice, and thyme. Hamilton blends his own, starting with undisclosed store-bought stuff and all those seasonings, plus ginger. Meats are dry rubbed with the mixture rather than sauced. Hamilton is best known for his rib and chicken dishes made spicy with his signature seasoning, then infused with Pimento Woods smoky flavor. Authentic jerk is cooked right on top of the wood. It's expensive and difficult to source, but is essential, he said. When he's cooking, you can count on ribs and rib tips. For sides, there will be baked beans and macaroni. He serves bacon mac and cheese and a crumbled mac and cheese with crispy breadcrumb topping for variety. Then there are jerk nachos and jerk salad. Jerk nacho orders start with the customer's choice of tortilla chips or flavored Doritos. Chips get topped with nacho cheese, jerk sauce, cilantro, sour cream, and jerk chicken. Jerk salad starts with the same chicken plus lettuce, spinach, hard-boiled egg, cheese, ranch dressing, and jerk sauce. "That's one thing I could eat every day," Hamilton said of his signature salad. He has his own techniques, some learned from other cooks, and then made his own. "I've messed up more food than the average person would barbecue in their lifetime," Hamilton said. He said he's been working on a new dish, jerk chicken Alfredo. "My wife loves it. I want to add it to the menu, but I want to perfect the jerk Alfredo sauce. I do make the Alfredo sauce from scratch," Hamilton said. It wasn't his cooking that won over his wife. He said he wasn't cooking anything then. Now he and June cook together in their certified home kitchen. "We divide and conquer," Hamilton said. He started barbecuing weekly about 10 years ago after following his twin sister from Chicago to Cedar Rapids. "I found it was a way to get my friends over and have a nice time," Hamilton said. Word spread that he was a good cook. Soon co-workers at a former job, Infinity, asked him to bring food to work. Friday afternoons, they'd often find Hamilton set up in the parking lot, the smoker going since 6 a.m. to have ribs ready for lunch. He'd take pre-orders and serve meals with a side of baked beans, pork-based or vegan, and macaroni. Between word of mouth and social media, his circle of fans grew. When Hamilton was ready to start catering and serving food on weekends at various sites, he had ready customers. When he sees people out and about or at Walmart, they ask him when he's going to cook again. For a few months, he worked out of a kitchen at the now-defunct Southside Steakhouse. Facebook became, and still is, the best place to find and follow, at BBQ Master D. Ham, to learn when, where, and what he is serving. We sell out pretty much every time we cook. We've seen an increase in the business every year since 2017, he said. Every year, I'd say it's doubled. His preference is catering because he likes seeing many people eating his food at the same time. That also helps to build his brand, plus gives him time to plan his time. He's still working a full-time sales job at TLC Associates and raising three kids with his wife, June. Hamilton gets in the zone when he's cooking. He turns on his favorite music and gets to work. The only thing I think about is how to make it good so that when people eat it, they're happy, they're satisfied, he said. If I could do this for the rest of my life and not work for anyone, I would love to do so. The goal for 2021 is to buy a food truck. By the summertime, we should be up and around, he said. That does it for the reading of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette on Iris. I've been your reader, Kathleen, still in sunny Arizona. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.